Okay, so I will be talking on quivers, so everything I do on quivers is joined with Ham Dirksen. So Ham Dirksen, and then I should say the last part also is joined with Ham student Calin Chindris, okay, the counterexample part. So, well, this is of course related to the talk of Christine that started the conference, but let me recall the definitions because I take also slightly different point of view. So, well, quiver is, as she defined, set of vertices Q0 and Q1 is a set of arrows. So Q0 is 1, 2, n, we'll always assume, and Q1 arrows I'll denote differently by just first letter from the alphabet, and each arrow will have head and tail. And right away, I'll say that I'll assume that Q has no oriented cycles because I'll be talking about semi-invariants, and well, we'll see that we need that for weight spaces to be finite dimensional. So, let me recall that we define, so K will be algebraically closed field. Algebraically closed. And we define the category rep KQ. These are attaching to each vertex a vector space. Everything is finite dimensional, and to each arrow we attach the linear map VA from the vector space at the tail to the vector space at the head. And for two representations we define the set of homomorphisms V and W and the rep KQ. We define hom Q VW, the set of families of maps, linear maps FX from VX to WX, and such that for every A in Q1, those squares that you already seen, VTA, VHA, WTA, WHA. So here we have the map V of A, here we have W of A, and here we have our maps F, and we require all those squares to commute. So if you have a quiver like this, for example, 1, 2, 3, then the representation will be just sequence of linear maps, and the map of representations will be just a ladder, the vertical maps such that all the squares commute. Okay, so dimension vectors, every representation has dimension vector, I'll denote them by alpha, dimension vector of V, usually beta, dimension vector of W. So this will be, well, associating to every X the dimension of the space at that vertex. And we are interested in the semi-invariants. So for each dimension vector, we have the representation space. And this is just the product over A in Q1, linear maps from K to beta TA, K to beta HA. So basically set of matrices. And then we define semi-invariants of a quiver and the dimension vector is the invariants. So we take the coordinate ring of the space rep Q beta. So this is a, basically we have a bunch of matrices with no conditions on them. So this will be just a polynomial ring on entries of those matrices. And then we take invariants with respect to the group SQ, SLQ beta, which SLQ beta is product X in Q0, SLQ beta X.
change the cycle, you assume that the corresponding diagram commutes?
Yes, that's right. So for example, if you take, you know, your quiver will be like this, you just get a vector space with an endomorphism, right? And so actually it's a theory of Jordan-Kanikoff form. Mm-hmm. But we exclude that case. Why? Because you see, also as Christian explained, semi-invariance, you can, if you treat from the point of view of the group GL, Q beta, then this will be polynomials in here that transform with some character of GL, right? So therefore, this will have this decomposition. Sigma are in characters of the group GL, Q beta, so it's really Z to the N, let's say, Si Q beta, beta sigma. So this ring of semi-invariance always will have this weight decomposition, and in fact we are interested in the cones of weights. So sigma Q beta will be the set of sigma in the N such that Si Q beta sigma is non-zero. Okay, so let me give one kind of running example that will allow us to keep something concrete in mind. Let's take this example. Let's take the quiver 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, so-called 4 subspace quiver. And the dimension vector will be, I write it, k, k squared, k squared, k, k, k. Okay, so for example, well, in this case, it's not difficult, let's say A, B, C, D, maybe A1, A2, A3, A4. In this case, it's not difficult to see that Si Q beta will be just the generated by delta ij. Delta ij is determinant Ai, Aj, or I should write Vai, Vaj. And of course, there will be one relation, delta 1, 2, delta 3, 4, minus delta 1, 3, delta 2, 4, plus delta 1, 4, delta 2, 3. And I should point out, so this actually, well, this equivalence actually was analyzed by Jerry and David even before I got interested, for example, in quivers. So they analyzed actually all ring of semi-invariance for the 4 subspace quiver. Anyway, so, and the weights. The way I'll denote the weights, when I have a determinant like this, I always put, see this delta 1, 2, for example, is the map from here plus here into here. So I always put 1s at the source and minus 1 at the domain. So weight sigma of delta 1, 2 would be 1, 1, 0, 0, minus 1. Okay? That will be the convention. So whenever you see a determinant, that will be the point. Okay. So so also remember, Christian defines this basically one linear map that explains homological algebra of quiver representations. The point is that this category is hereditary. It will have homes and only x to 1, no higher x, and this can be explained by this map that she wrote down. So basically if we have V and W two representations, then we write the following linear map, Wx into A in Q1, here x is in Q0, home Vta WhA, and the map dvw was taking dvw. Now I apply it to those family of maps phi x, which do not satisfy any conditions, and this goes to the family. If I would put phi x here, the diagram would not commute, so it goes to the family of maps from here to here, which tells you that you have go this way and subtract the map going this way, like she wrote. So this would be phi h a v a minus w a phi t a, and then it becomes clear that the kernel is home Q VW, because in the kernel you have exactly those families that commute, and then it's not difficult to see that you get the co-kernel will be X Q VW 0. So this gives you all homes and X, and the point is now that you can see now that the Euler characteristic of two representations, which will be dimension of this minus dimension of this, will just depend on the dimension vectors on V and W, because also it will be dimension of this minus dimension of this. So now I get the chance to mention Euler. We have this Euler form. So remember, this has dimension vector alpha, this has dimension vector beta. So alpha beta is summation x in Q0, alpha x beta x minus summation a in Q1, alpha ta beta ha. So we started with this result that relates the semi-invariant two representations, namely, so these are the Scofield semi-invariant that also Christine defined. So if now we take two dimension vectors such that the value of Euler form is zero, so dimension of this is equal to the dimension of this, you can take a determinant. And then determinants usually are SL invariant. It happens in this case. So see what we can do. We can fix V and start moving W around, and we get a semi-invariant. So we define CV. So we assume that alpha beta is 0. And we define CV, which will send W to determinant of this dVW. And this CV will be a semi-invariant on dimension vector beta, and one can also calculate which weight it will have. I'll show this in a minute here. Namely, the weight will be a linear form that you get when you put alpha on the first coordinate of this Euler form. Okay, I should point out, so let's look at this example a little bit. Of the four subspace quiver. You see, this Euler form can be also given in matrix form. So I can write this Euler form as alpha beta to be alpha e beta t, where I treat alpha as a row vector. So in our in the example, our matrix E will be just 5x5 matrix, where what do? I put 1s on the diagonal, and then I put minus 1s where the arrows are. So there is arrow from 1 to 5, from 2 to 5, from 3 to 5, and 4 to 5. Okay. So this is the Euler matrix for our for subspace quiver. And you see now, if you start analyzing examples of small quivers, you will see, for example, if I look at the weight of this delta 1, 2, this weight 1, 1, 0, 0, minus 1 will be the sum of this row, and I think of this row. And whenever you will see a determinant, you will notice from the example that's what happens always. And what does this mean? This means that it comes from the dimension vector 1, 1, 0, 0, 1, comma, slash. So it exactly comes from the representation V. And actually, you see, for this quiver, you have the indecomposable representation that has dimension k at 1, 2, and 5, and the identity maps A1 and A2. So this turns out happens in general. So basically, all semi-invariants are of the form CV. So this was the first theorem, which then so theorem one, Dirksen, that basically if sigma is not of the type alpha slash, so Q has no oriented cycles here, if sigma is not of the type alpha slash, where alpha has non-negative coordinates, it's a dimension vector, then SIQ beta, beta is zero, sigma, and if sigma equals alpha slash, with maybe condition alpha beta is zero, then SIQ beta sigma is spanned as a vector space by semi-invariants CV, with V is in rep Q alpha. Okay, so this, if one couples it with some work of Schofield, then allows to describe the cones of weights, but it's kind of the description that is still maybe not the real description. So the theorem 2 is the description of the first description of sigma q beta, but in order to do this I need to define one little notion. Namely, I will say that beta prime, if I have a quiver q and two dimension vectors, then beta prime is a sub-representation vector for beta if every w in rep q beta has a sub-representation of dimension beta prime, and then sigma q beta can be described by one homogeneous equality and a bunch of homogeneous linear inequalities. Namely, this is a set of all sigma in Zn such that sigma equals alpha slash, alpha beta is zero, and alpha beta prime is smaller or equal than zero for every beta prime sub-representation vector of beta, right? Okay. Basically what happens is that you see interpreting semi-invariants by in this way, semi-invariants in a certain weight will vanish if for generic choice of something in dimension beta and dimension alpha, this matrix will be non-degenerate. So this will mean that general home between the representations in those dimension vectors will be zero, and general X will be zero, and basically Schofield analyzed this homes, and well, having vanishing then allows to. Okay, so this of course gives this saturation. Sigma q beta is saturated, which means that if n sigma is in sigma q beta for positive n, then sigma is also in sigma q beta. Okay? So, and the example really we have in mind is related to multiple flux, the example in which this cone sigma q beta has an interesting interpretation is the triple flux quiver, so TNNN. This is a quiver with the following vertices. and dimension vector. Equals I. So 1, 2, 3, etc. So then, of course, a representation of this quiver in this dimension vector with some genericity assumption that all maps are injective will give us three flags. So rep q beta, one could say, contains triple flags. And then, if one does a standard calculation, basically decomposing coordinate ring, one gets this Kliatchko cone here, namely sigma TNNN. Maybe let's call this beta hat, particular beta. Beta hat can be identified with the triples of highest weight for GLN, sub that, so lambda mu nu, highest weight, maybe for SLN. For SLN, such that V lambda tensor V mu, tensor V nu, SLN is non-zero. So in this case, one gets the saturation. Okay, so this was kind of the old story. We had this, so it's already a few years old. Well, this, in special case, this is a proof of the saturation. Yeah, by, that's right, but...
So why didn't you do it first?
Why didn't I do it first? Because, I don't know, that's just when I kind of got interested in semi-invariants of Fourier by themselves. So, you know, to see that it's connected, but... although this proof, I must say, is algebraic geometry only counting dimension of some incidence varieties. We'll see the some other... instance of this a little later, one example. Okay, so so of course now one wants to interpret, since semi-invariants come from representations, one would like to interpret more things in terms of representation theory. For example, the dimensions of the weight spaces. And it turns out that again, for any quiver without oriented cycles, one can just give a formula for dimensions of the weight spaces in complete generality, namely so suppose I want to calculate SI dimension SI q beta in the weight alpha slash with the assumption of course that alpha beta is zero. So this is theorem 3, and this we proved together with Schofield. So this has the following interpretation. This, I call it N alpha plus beta. This is a number, N alpha plus beta, is the number of sub-representations of dimension vector alpha in a general sub-representation, in a general representation of dimension alpha plus beta. And actually, let me just tell you conceptual what the proof is, because here at least the idea is extremely, and the reason for this is rather clear. So it's still really an elementary fact. Namely, you see what you can do. Well, you want to count such representations, right? So what you do, of course, you look at the incidence variety, alpha plus beta. This will be basically what you do with determinant of varieties. it will be sitting inside of rep q alpha plus beta times you choose a bunch of Grassmannians of the right dimension, so basically subspaces of dimensions alpha, Grassmannian k to alpha x, subspaces of dimension alpha x in k alpha plus beta x. And here you will pick this incidence variety, this set of pairs, V, and then bunch of subspaces Rx, such that Rx is a subrepresentation. So now, of course, you have a projection P on this, on the product of Grassmannians. And now, well, if you go to Fulton's book on intersection theory, you will find a formula for the generic fiber, and it will be some, you know, calculating in product of Grassmannians by Schubert calculus, which are Schubert varieties. Okay, but now, so there's this side, but now you can start calculating this. So you're looking at K rep Q beta. So you decompose it in symmetric algebra on the direct sum of those homs, and you start using Cauchy formulas for decomposing, and the semi-invariant will be one-dimensional subrepresentation. So you calculate with representations of GLN, but you see calculating in Grassmannian, multiplying Schubert cycles and multiplying representations is given by the same rule, by the little Richardson rule. So if you do it correctly, you get the same calculation, basically. So it requires, you know. So one gets this formula for the dimensions of the weight spaces. But of course, why am I doing this? Especially thinking about this example, the first description of the cone involves many redundant inequalities. Okay, if you take those inequalities of the type alpha, beta prime, smaller or equals than zero, a lot of them are redundant. So really what we are after the describing exactly the walls of this cone. Okay, and we would like to do it for arbitrary quiver. And it turns out, again, we have now a precise description, but this will require maybe a little bit of explanation. So let me talk a little bit about the exceptional sequences, because this was the motivation for the description of the walls of the cone. And this also is related to the counterexample at the end. So Schofield has this technique, very nice technique, of orthogonal categories, which allows you to embed one quiver into another. So namely, so here's how it goes. So I define V in the rep KQ is exceptional if HOM KVV is just K, so endomorphism are just it's a sure representation, and X KVV is zero. So what this means, it means it will be an indecomposable representation which is an open orbit in its dimension vector. These are so-called sure, real sure roots. Okay, and it turns out, exactly like Christine did in her the first talk, that if you have the representation, this exceptional representation, you define this orthogonal category. And you can do this is the set of W's such that HOM QVW equals XQVW is zero. And Schofield proved a remarkable theorem that if you have such exceptional object, then this orthogonal category would be isomorphic to representations of another quiver on n minus 1 vertices, but not necessarily subquiver of our quiver. So V perp is isomorphic to rep K Q prime. Q prime has n minus 1 vertices. Let me just give you a very small example of how it goes, just so we see at least that it's not just restricting the quiver. Let's take some quiver like this. 1, 2, 3, and two arrows from here to here and here to here. And let's take V to be general representation and dimension vector kk squared 0. So dimension vector 1 to 0. Then it's clear that there's an open orbit and it's indecomposable because you have to put those two maps to go to the two basis vectors. It will be the open orbit. So you see, the way you do it, obviously, all dimension vectors of the object from here have to be orthogonal in the sense of Euler form. So we just look at this 1 to 0 times our Euler matrix on the vector beta. And if you do the calculation for this Euler matrix, you will get that you'll get beta 1 minus 2 beta 3. So we are looking at the vectors beta 1, beta 2, beta 3. And we are looking how many indecomposable simple representations we can get here. So obviously there's two obvious choices. You can choose the object of the dimension vector gamma, which is 0, 1, 0. This would be orthogonal to this 1, 2, 0. But you see, you would like to choose also 2, 0, 1, but 2, 0, 1 is not good because there will be no indecomposable representation here. So we have to choose 2, 1, 1. Okay? One that will not change. So delta equals 2, 1, 1. And then what you do, you just see to which quiver it corresponds. You just restrict the Euler form. Okay? And you see that gamma, gamma equals 1, delta, delta equals 1, and gamma, delta is minus 3. So you can see this as a quiver with two vertices with three arrows. So basically, the restriction of the Euler form. So basically, what Scofield does, he proves that there are always n minus 1 simple objects, okay? And if one restricts the Euler form to those dimension vectors, you can treat it as a new quiver. It will have n minus 1 vertices. So this Euler form for the smaller quiver embeds isometrically to the form of the big quiver. And now the point is that you see if one adds it together with the theorem about weight spaces of semi-invariants, it turns out that such embedding occurs also with preserving the dimension of the weight spaces of semi-invariants. Because basically, counting semi-invariants reduces to counting sub-representations. So then you really can see how many sub-representations you have in this orthogonal category. And if you do some work, you will see that if you are in this orthogonal category, you kind of cannot have more. So the point is, if I have such situation, then if I have the embedding for Q, if I have V exceptional and V perp is rep Q prime, then I have this embedding from dimension vectors ZQ prime 0 into ZQ 0. Then if I take two dimension SI Q beta alpha slash is equal to dimension, I should write Q prime here, SI Q I of beta I of alpha slash. So this allows you to prove things about the, well, those multiplicities, you see. So sometimes if you know something about the small quiver, you will know something about the very big quiver. Okay. It has more arrows, yes. It has more arrows, yes, but has less vertices. Okay, yeah, that's right. For well, Well, they're clearly equally complicated because the rings will be the same, right? So it's the same quotient, but realized in different way. But okay. Okay. So then, of course, you see, the same, of course, will be true for the other category. And I could define the left orthogonal category in the same way. For the exceptional object, the same theorem goes just by inverting the arrows. So this leads to this very nice, maybe I mentioned it has no direct bearing on the rest, but there's this theorem of exceptional sequences, right, due to Crowley-Bouvier, right? So we'll say that definition, a sequence of E1, EN is exceptional if and only if, so we fix a quiver Q, if EI are exceptional objects, and B, EJ is in EI orthogonal when I is smaller than J. So this is a very interesting kind of set of bases in the dimension, space of dimension vectors. So you see, from this it follows that you can, if you have one exceptional object, you can always put it inside of some exceptional sequence, and then one has those mutations, right? So here, there's a braid group action. Braid group action. Here I take exactly the biggest possible length, n is the number of vertices in Q, action on set of exceptional sequences. And you see, in a sense, you can see this braid group action because basically, again, this Scofield technique really well allows you to see it in the following way. Basically, you see, if I have a I want to see how the ith braid generator acts on those two EII plus one, right? So what do? Well, I take orthogonal categories from the left to the right, and it reduces to the case of two vertices. So you just need to see it for the case of two vertices, okay? And for two vertices, it's easy. It's so-called Coxeter element, okay? So that's right. So for two vertices, EI, E1, E2, will go to E2, I think, tau plus E1. So somehow you handle the case of two. Of course, you have to prove braid relations, but again, this technique to prove braid relations, you just need to handle the case of three vertices, you see, because you always, so the quiver becomes smaller somehow, because even though you have many arrows. Okay, so I mention all this because somehow the description of the walls of the cone is inspired by this exceptional sequences. One just has to modify the definition of those exceptional sequences to involve also so-called imaginary sure roots. So let me make the following definition. Alpha is a sure root if general representation in the ref Q alpha is indecomposable. Okay, and they come in kind of variety of three. They can be real, which means alpha alpha is one. They can be isotropic, alpha alpha is zero, and they can be imaginary. So now one can describe the walls of the cone for arbitrary Q without oriented cycles and for arbitrary codimension. So we define a sequence gamma 1, gamma s. This will be now a sequence of dimension vector. It's a of dimension vector. It's a sure quiver sequence. If and only if, first, each gamma I is a sure root. Second, for I smaller than j, implies dimension Siq gamma I, gamma j, gamma I is 1. So this is an important rigidity condition that somehow the dimension of spaces of semi-invariants have to be just 1. I maybe comment at the end if I have some time on that. And third, for each I smaller than j, then we have gamma j, gamma I is smaller than 0. You see, this implies that Euler from gamma I, gamma j is equal to 0 because this dimension space is one-dimensional, it's non-zero. So somehow, in terms of Euler form, I again have orthogonality one way, but then I insist that it behaves like a quiver. I have arrows going the other way. There is a sure quiver sequence. And the point is that in terms of those sure quiver sequences describe the walls of those cones. So in particular, for the triple flat quiver, one gets a description of all walls of this classical cone for arbitrary codimension. Okay, so this, I think, was before known only for by Knudson, Woodward, and Tau in that case for codimension 1. And actually, the statement that I'll give is exactly equivalent to their statement in that case. So, the theorem, I think 4. So basically, the walls, the point is like this. Okay, well, let me just write it. So FRQ alpha, FRQ alpha are the walls of sigma Q alpha of dimension R. And WRQ alpha is a set of sure quiver sequences, gamma 1, gamma R, such that, maybe I write it here, sure sequences gamma 1, gamma r, such that the dimension vector alpha can be written as a linear combination. And also, we have ci is 1 if gamma I is imaginary. And then, basically, the theorem is that there's a bijection. There's a bijection xi from WRQ alpha to FRQ alpha, and basically the sequence gamma 1 gamma R will go to the hyperplane, which is defined by inequalities . What all this means, one can think of this in the following way, and let me just, we don't have time to go through the details. So the point is that, you see, I have this cone sigma q alpha. So one can think about each weight sigma and its multiples about some semi-stability condition, okay? And then I have the GIT quotient with this semi-stability condition. So the point is that now, I think I have to assume maybe that alpha is a sure root. So the point is that if I take the weight inside of the cone, then this dimension vector will be stable. But as I go to the wall of the cone, there will be the filtration by the stable factors will have more and more factors. So really those gamma i's are the dimension vectors of the stable factors. So depending on which of wall of which codimension you have, you are, you have more and more factors, with, again, taking into account that if you have imaginary root, it cannot repeat, but if you would have isotropic or real root, it could repeat if you have a multiple. So that's a description of the cone, and it turns out already So of course now the question is, for example, can I, from this technique, can I deduce something about the case of most interest, the case of Littlewood-Richardson coefficients? And in fact, one can deduce several things. Well, just the description itself, but notice the following thing. So the consequences for Littlewood-Richardson coefficients. So there are maybe two, and then I'll go to the main application with this counterexample. Okay, so one is, for example, what happens when I have the extremal ray? Okay. From this description, one can see, again, immediately, if I have the extremal ray, so this is the wall of the maximal possible codimension of dimension one, then you see, one can see right away that in this Schur-Quiver sequence, all roots except of one have to be the real roots. And then one applies the embedding theorem, and this means that you get the same ring of semi-invariance for the two vertex quiver. So if sigma is an extremal ray, then if I take the ring of semi-invariance beta and sigma, just going along this ray, it's isomorphic to Si, well, let's call it theta n, theta m. This will be the quiver 1, 2, m arrows in some, for some dimension vector, say gamma for that quiver. Okay? So that, for example, I think with this one can really give the, for triple flags, the examples of extremal rays where the ring of semi-invariance were, are complicated. This I don't think was known before. And the second one is a multiplication formula, product formula, basically, I don't want to state it because, I mean, exactly, but what happens is that if I'm on the wall, I have the Littlewood-Richardson coefficient on the wall, so one of those essential inequalities of Klyavsky becomes an equality if one of Klyavsky inequalities is an equality, then basically, the Littlewood-Richardson coefficient becomes a product of two smaller Littlewood-Richardson coefficients. Okay, so our coefficient becomes a product. Basically, what you do, you have equality for some parts of your partition, so you take those parts and the complementary parts, so you get two Littlewood-Richardson coefficients, and this one is a product of smaller R coefficient. But the nicest application so far, yes. Well, you have to deduce it. I mean, it will be some dimension vector, but you know, but you can, that's right. You just using those orthogonal categories, you see, the Scofield technique allows you to calculate the dimension of the simple module. So when you go down to two vertices, you will see which dimension vector. One has to know, yeah, from the Scofield, yeah, how to reduce to the smaller. Okay, so there are several, you see, attempts. So there was a saturation, which still becomes a little mysterious. It's still is a little mysterious because there's no kind of clear-cut reason why it's true. For example, it's not true that something in, so you know, the saturation for Littlewood-Richardson coefficients, of course, translates if I have three representations, R, lambda, mu, nu. And I have this Littlewood-Richardson C lambda mu nu, this multiplicity of V nu in V lambda tensor V mu. Then the saturation in this case means saturation means that if C n lambda n mu n nu is non-zero, then C lambda mu nu is also non-zero. So for example, if you think in terms of semi-invariant, it's not true that, for example, invariance in this weight would generate semi-invariance in this weight would generate semi-invariance in this way. So this would not be an explanation. So people try to kind of think why something like this could be true. So Onkunkov had this conjecture. It was about the growth of this function. Basically, if you take the function f of n equals cn lambda n mu n nu, he conjectures that it's logarithmically concave, meaning fn squared is bigger or equal than fn plus 1 times fn minus 1. This, by the way, implies what we need, implies that f of n is smaller or equal than f of 1 squared. So this turns out to be not true, and I mean completely not true, unfortunately, meaning that, well, in a sense you will see why. So basically the idea is, well, you do something for a very small quiver and you embed it in a triple slug quiver, right? Because one has all this technique. And the point is, what is the smallest quiver that one has a chance? Well, that's the smallest wild quiver, okay? Which means this one. Let's see which way I want the arrows to go. For some reason, I want like this. Three arrows, we need a wild one, okay? And you see, we need a root which is the imaginary root. So we need a root beta, well, and we just take the simplest possible, 1, 1, okay? Beta, beta is equals to minus 1. And you see, here's the reason really why but this what I really need is that f of 2 is smaller or equal than f of 1 squared. Okay, that's, yeah. Sorry. Okay, so now for alpha we have to take 2, 1, because that's the only, if you do the Euler form, which is 1 minus 3, 0, 1, that's the only orthogonal one, so that alpha beta is 0. And, well, you can just calculate the coefficients. In this case, you can just even do it by hand. Let's see. Then basically, dimension Si theta 3 beta in the weight n sigma, so sigma is alpha slash, is n choose 2, n plus 2 choose 2, and dimension Si theta 2 beta in n sigma, in 2 n sigma, equals n plus 5 choose 5. And you see, so, and then see, you see, it's, in a sense, it's completely clear, because if you have the imaginary root, then the number of parameters you expect is always 1 minus beta beta. So here you have a quotient of dimension 2. For 2 beta, it would be quotient of dimension 4. So anyway, so this is a polynomial of degree 5. This is a polynomial of degree 2. So eventually, for big N, this will be bigger than the square of that. Okay? So you just embed now the equivalent of triple flag quiver, and it's not so difficult. So here's embedding. We just need two sure roots, and so the two sure roots that we have is epsilon 1 is, and actually for some reason we'll use this quiver. So epsilon 1 will go to 1, 2, 3, 0, 3, 4, 1, 1, 2, 3. And epsilon 2 is just 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, 0. And now you calculate the Euler form epsilon to epsilon 1, no, epsilon to epsilon 1 is, you see, minus 3, because it's from here to here. And basically, well, then you calculate epsilon 1 is 1, epsilon 2 is 1. Okay, you have to check that these are sure roots and you are done, because the dimensions are carry over. So, and actually for n equals 21, there's the first value when this guy exceeds square of this. So you need n equals 21. Okay? So this means that the flags you get are really big, because so really this is a space of dimension 84. This one can see this one. Okay? So that's how it goes. But one can then, once you see the partitions, then you can even prove directly by Littlewood-Richardson rules that really the multiplicities are n plus 2, you know, n plus 2 choose 2 and n plus 5. So that's really, in a sense, bad news, but at least one can see that there is some use. But you see, what this means that if I take, I can give those examples by the bushels, you know, any small quiver, and then just let it embed in a big flag. Probably if one would be more cautious, one could you know, one would need to have some technique to find sure roots. Basically, if you take any triple flag quiver, okay, as soon as it's wild, one can embed this guy into this. So in terms of just length, you know, so it just fails. I think more or less all the things for small n are just very special for triple flag that people kind of see. Huh? But so I wouldn't say, I don't think it can be somehow saved, because anything that really comes from wild quiver, you know, I mean, what can be simpler than this dimension vector 1, 1? So, okay, so that's everything. Thank you very much.